Meditieren, Yoga, Joggen, nichts entspannt mich.
Echt? Mich entspannt meine Steuer total.
Steuer? Wie Finanzamt? Die Steuererklärung?
Ja, ich habe ganz locker über 1000 Euro zurückbekommen.
Hast du geheime Connections oder Excel-Superkräfte?
Nö, nur die Wieso-Steuer-App.
Wow, und das ist einfach?
Klar, die macht fast alles automatisch.
Ich fühle mich plötzlich so entspannt.
Hol dir dein Geld zurück. Abgabefrist 31. Juli.
Was?
Schaffst du ganz entspannt mit Wieso-Steuer.
Ach, ja.
Universe season 35, episode number 8, as we wrap up February with this, the conclusion of a banger, as this is act 2 of Caesar's Messiah, the Roman conspiracy to invent Jesus. This is a book by Joseph Atwell, which we began on the Plus extension last Friday, which would be season 35, episode 7. If you guys want to check that one out, go check it out first. And if you're like, where can I find this legendary work of broadcast genius? Why, it's just down in the links below down there in the show description. That's where you could sign up to become a Plus member, and you get both shows, Inescapables out. You get all of this extra stuff that we're doing, the Tuesdays, the extra extensions on Fridays. Come hang out. It's absolutely amazing. Now, in the meantime, and on this episode, we continue the work of Sir Mr. Joseph Atwell with our look at the origin of the Gospels of the Bible to see if there are any alternate perspectives with the official interpretations and to discover the motives behind its existence in the first place. I'm your happy host, Brandon Thomas, and with me, as always, is Joe Nah and the whale, Hodgden.
Yes, and like Brandon said, if you didn't hear the first part of this, you might want to go check out the first portion, because I'm sure you'll give a little catch-up, right?
Wrapping this thing up, it is a massive story. We, of course, touched in the beginning about Joseph's work on just uncovering why the Gospels were written in Greek. Who was this Jesus character anyway? You know, why was the religion even headquartered in Rome? A lot of questions to do with the Bible. And he asked some great ones, which we lay out the very first part of in the very first episode. So, guys, definitely go check that out, last Friday's extension. But, Joe, before we get to all that, what do you have coming up in this extension?
That is a great question, because I've been pulled in about three different directions trying to figure out what I want to do for the extension, and I have to make a choice. So it's between, let's see, what's the name of this first one here? The first one is, it's in my notes somewhere, I've a bunch of different stuff. Experiences of Changed Reality, this first one by Dirk Guillebelle, and that, I mean,
I like the name of the book and the name of the guy. That's a fun author's name to say.
The second one is about, see, I've got too many things open now. it's about a psychedelic afterlife stuff with the Native American traditions. And then I also had a third one that I don't have pulled up. So I don't know. Stick around for Plus and you'll find out which one I pick.
We'll all find out together. I love this. It's like a choose your own adventure, and I'm here for it, man.
I just wait for the guides to tell me which one to do, because I haven't heard from them in a while, so hopefully they pop up.
Oh shit, are you kind of on your own?
Yeah.
All right, maybe a coin flip will do you know?
Yeah.
Now, check the links in the show description again, guys, for the new Inescapable podcast, as well as all of the ancillary links and references provided for you to empower your expansion with this particular journey right here. This is, again, the continuation of the last Plus extension from last Friday's episode. So get signed up for Plus, get both shows in this for the same investment here, and then catch the first bit of this tale, because you're absolutely going to want to. But back to the awesome.
Yeah, where did we leave off on this story anyway? Catch me up, at least.
Yeah, so we left off pretty much to where he was sitting there explaining all of the correlations between how Judaism at the time needed a new Messiah. They were ready for a new prophet, rather, because their prophecies prophesied it. And then these Titus Flavian Romans walked in with the Judeo-Claudian playbook and basically created an entire new religion for these folks. And the whole point of this was to pacify the Jews at the time and to give them a new religion. But essentially what happened is there's this thing called typology, which we're going to break into in this episode, which we mentioned briefly on the last one, that plays out, it's a playbook. And this is how this Atwell guy was able to discover this, is because they're succinct. The old scripts, the Judeo-Claudian scripts that said, look, if you play these out as well as the old metaphors that relayed true wisdom, there is calculated, just like you mentioned Joseph Campbell's hero's journey. It's a, yes, predictable pattern, right? And this typology appears in the Bible. And we left off on that if you worship Jesus, you're basically worshiping a Caesar in disguise. So the whole point here was to glorify Caesar. And we're going to go over now correlations between Jesus and Titus, the parables in the book, and then the history that actually occurred to see what's going on with this whole thing in this episode and just Excellent. Wrap this thing up. So the Flavians may have used Jesus as a Messiah more to their liking to get the Jews to worship Caesar as a god. But is there any actual history to this character? His name is the mystery. In Greek, Jesus means savior and Christ means Messiah. And these words were already significant in Judaism before Jesus Christ supposedly existed. Major biblical figures to a Jewish Greek speaking populace would already be called Christ. So it wasn't a unique name that suddenly appeared.
Right. It's a title, right? Christ is actually just a title.
Exactly. Yeah.
So his name isn't Jesus H. Christ. It's Jesus the Christ.
No, only Jesus H. Christ when you hit your finger with the hammer. Do we call in his middle name?
Right.
What we know now about Jesus Christ, the man, is uncertain. Though quite possibly your homeboy, as many blended fabric teas may claim to proclaim, there is no historical evidence to support the existence that particular Jesus ever existed. Now, Joe, did you get the blended fabrics reference there?
No, that one slipped right past my head.
All right, well, for the nerds, which we are and adore, the Bible prohibits the wearing of clothing made of blended fabrics, specifically a mixture of wool and linen, referred to as shatnets in Hebrew. Oi, take off that meshugana shatnets. This is blended fabrics. This is if you have any unnatural or blended fabrics. So let's say polyester, fucking anything. Cotton and polyester. If you've got a blend of any type, the Bible specifically prohibits that shit.
Funny is I read something the other day about how that's actually the blended fabrics have something to do with interfering with your EMFs or your body's, you know, natural magnetic aura or something like that. But I'd have to look more into it.
I'm certain of it. Yeah, that would make sense. It's a push from the realm, and those exist in all forms. So if your blended fabrics, you've already been told by the Great Book, which is a older parable in that. Now, that is found in Leviticus 19:19 and Deuteronomy, which is fun to say, 22:11. This prohibition was part of the ceremonial law intended to set the Israelites apart as holy and separate from surrounding nations. So it was a metaphor for not blending cultures. It was actually a bit racist if you think about it. So your shirt shouldn't do that, damn it. Now, of course, linked is the classic Jesus is my homeboy t-shirt, the 100% cotton one, which is labeled premium in their description there. And there are at least 8 other options as far as the true and divine Jesus is my homeboy t-shirt is concerned, though only one can be the true Messiah honoring Jesus is my homeboy t-shirt. So choose wisely. Beware the temptation of unholy impersonation of those blended fashion false idols. Now, investigating the historical Jesus as opposed to the Christ of faith reveals a void. While we might expect the core details of Jesus to be readily known, we find no such thing. Archaeological evidence of Jesus Christ has never been discovered, and there's no established and incontrovertible biography of Jesus. This leads to a straight-up twilight zone of early Christian belief. All right, here we go. You're traveling through another dimension. A dimension not only of sight and sound, but of mind. A journey into a wondrous land whose boundaries are that of the imagination. That's the signpost up ahead. Your next stop, the motherfucking Twilight Zone. The development of the religious movement around the idea of a man wasn't based on legends about a real person. Instead, it was a religious movement. The gospel doesn't provide a physical description of Jesus. The presentation of Jesus is a composite of many messianic leaders of the time, most of whom met a bad end, usually by crucifixion fiction, due to the Romans' affinity for the punishment of seditious activita. So, in conclusion, we're dealing with literature, not history, and therefore, there's no history. Though there is some fantastic wisdom, I must say, couched in metaphor, that is valuable. It's a planting guide, it's a realm orienter, it's a discernment sharpener, tissue salt instructions, and so much more. It does have a ton of value. The point he's making, and the point I find very interesting, is that idea that it's literal and that you've got to take this stuff literally rather than apply it to your life in a meaningful way. The character of Jesus is entirely a literary creation. The Romans saw the Jews' reliance on a prophecy and gave them a prophet. The Roman authors borrowed religious concepts from Judaism and other gods and religions. Now, some scholars have noticed similarities between the story of Jesus and ancient pagan mysteries, as we've talked about as well. Now, in ancient mythology, solar mythology emerged, where gods took on solar attributes as agricultural communities became more important. This would obviously be what they revered. If the sun didn't work, their plants didn't grow. The sun became personified, leading to the development of male sun gods. Christianity usurped much of the sun worship, and some believe that Jesus was a sun god transformed into a Jewish man.
Well, yeah, that seems pretty obvious. If you want to go back way, way back when, you know, hunter-gatherer times, they anthropomorphized the sun because it was the source of all life. If the sun wasn't there, they would perish. And I mean, it made, like you said, it made the crops grow. It gave warmth. It gave light. Everything. So it was the main thing in these early civilizations' lives. Like that, it came up every day. They're like, "Oh, praise the God! The sun came back again, and it returned again." And yeah.
And they say this too about the crab, the cancer, and why, you know, sex and procreation are done at night, because the cancer of the crab is associated with procreation. So it's a procreation in the physical. Cancer is its opposite would be Capricorn. That's procreation or spiritual, sex, spiritual. So anyway, the whole idea here is that if you've got just the sun running around you during the day, you don't feel like there's some invisible guy watching you 24 hours a day. That had to be invented later as a stronger control mechanism. That's why the sexing was done at night, because God was asleep. He couldn't see you. Sort of like the poop hole loophole that you've heard about. Have you heard about this?
No.
Oh, it's great. The Christian kids believe that if they do butt stuff, that God can't see that because it's not vaginal sex. So therefore, it doesn't count.
Yeah, it's where the sun don't shine. Literally.
Literally. So God's not there. Sun God worship. Sun don't shine. Poop hole loophole.
Well, I think that's a Mormon thing. But the crab is a weird thing to be associated with the hanky-panky, don't you think?
It's ancient. So this is, because it's all, again, anthropomorphized. So is the Zodiac. And it's very prolific throughout the Bible as well. So when they're talking about sex, usually sometimes, I mean, Scorpio as well has that attribute, but the doing it in darkness has to do with the crab's activities and the shuffle side to side and that kind of thing. It's anthropomorphized as human sex or bodily procreation at the North Node, which is Cancer there. As we've already discussed, on December 25th, the birthday of Jesus was actually the winter solstice and the end of the three-day period when the sun appears to die and is reborn. The ancient mystery cults had experiential and philosophical spirituality with initiatory myths that helped people achieve spiritual awakenings called gnosis. And this is something that you've talked about, this initiation process where they would practice death and they would be very familiar with what that process was to their best of their ability so that they were prepared for it. And that's some of these philosophical and spirituality initiatory myths he's talking about here. Now, these myths contain elements that later became the Jesus story. Can Jesus be considered developed from pre-existing literary characters? Each episode in Jesus's life can be traced to a prior representation of that time. So the pagan mystery school myths contain a story of a dying and resurrecting Son of God born of a virgin with 12 disciples, turning water into wine at a wedding, introducing a new religion of love, accused of heresy or provocation, crucified, and then communion with the God-man through bread and wine for eternal life. This is Christianity. Now, Easter is a long pre-Christian celebration of spring's resurrection from winter's death. And this is something that you talked about on the last show. That's one of the pagan adaptations that's obviously pagan. It's obviously pagan. This ancient shamanic rite involves a ritual death and rebirth, awakening the higher nature from the lower one. The Old Testament parallels exist in Jewish mythology. For instance, the ascension in the New Testament echoes the dramatic ascension of the Old Testament figure Elijah. These two Jewish prophets, Elijah and Elisha, share story elements with Jesus, such as multiplying food, raising the dead, water miracles, and ultimately, ascension to heaven. Christianity used Old Testament characters and scriptures as a blueprint to create its new one. Many Christian ethics existed before Christianity, like the Old Testament's "do unto others as you would have them do unto you." Many aspects of Christian ethics that we admire can be found in Stoic philosophy in Rome, which, by the way, is exactly the philosophical and ethical school promoted by the Flavians. There's little that is original about Jesus. If you separate his words from the advice that benefited the Roman imperial family, you're left with snippets of widely known philosophies, truisms, and concepts from prior Hebraic literature. Atwell is now well convinced that there is no historical Jesus because there's no evidence for a historical man that stands up to scrutiny. So what do you think?
What's the counter-argument to that? Does he give any? Because I know especially hardcore Christians are going to have a problem with that.
I don't know what they would present in argument, because that's the thing. You've got to – I bet it's met with a lot of nuh-uh. I don't know that a lot of folks really have a historical argument to base this on, because we already know that it's riddled with metaphor. We know that. And if it's riddled with metaphor, then that also adds this element. And that's another thing to add this element to it, is that there's historical concepts that it was apprehended by this Flavian guy to make himself look like a god because Jesus predicted his coming. And that's the whole point here, is that it sets that up. It's multiple birds with one stone. And for generations, it's a brilliant work, but also it's a brilliant work. There's a lot of great shit in there if you stop taking it literally, which is, again, what Atwell hopes to point out here, is to separate the baby from the bathwater he allegedly walked on, right?
No.
Now, Atwell is well convinced that there is no historical Jesus because there's no evidence for this historical man that stands up to scrutiny. The story of Jesus is full of motifs from the pagan mysteries. In the early Christian movement, there were two types of Christians, Gnostics and Literalists. The Literalists became the Roman Empire, and the Roman Catholic Church believed in a historical Jesus, offering the story to be taken literally. The Gnostics saw it allegorically, and their heresy was that Christ didn't come into flesh. The history books have been written by the Literalists, so the traditions about the Romans torturing and suppressing Christians are correct. They definitely persecuted the messianic militaristic Christians. They would have frowned on Gnostic independent Christians, but promoted Roman pacifists who gave to Caesar what was Caesar's.
And so the main idea here is that if you take it literally, it's a lot easier to control the masses because you have a direct punishment for your sins and all that, instead of just, what would they even say, look inward, because it's an allegory, so you have to apply it to yourself and not to, you know, a group of people, maybe?
Absolutely, and this is that Panopticon that you talked about on the Tuesday show, this self-governing prison, because you think somebody's watching you all the time and it gives you these rules and it's very clear about, man, even though you want to go overthrow the Roman Empire, you shouldn't, because you should turn the other cheek. You should offer that dude what's his. That's what God wants you to do. And we put the fear of God in you. And now it makes a lot more sense for the fire and brimstone type preachers who only preach the scary things about if you don't believe you're going to go. Well, this makes sense for those to be so promoted as well in this terrifying go against, if there was such a movement, because then you're policing yourself. Again, this Panopticon thing, it's a brilliant idea and it's completely apt here for sure.
Well, and self-censorship is still pushed very much today, but just in a digital way, I guess.
Yes, absolutely. 100%. And then again, the thought that cameras are everywhere. Oh, you're being watched all the time, all this kind of shit. So they would have frowned on Gnostic independent Christians, but would have promoted Roman pacifists who gave to Caesar what is Caesar's. This suited the fascist Roman Empire with a simple message. Just believe this. You don't have to transform, and you don't have to go through the authorities, bishops, and states. They picked it up and used it. So you could see how this worked so well. All right, so let's get into the Son of Man. Now, our scholars agree that the Gospels are complex literary creations drawing from pagan and Jewish myth. Joseph Atwell goes further, claiming that the Flavians wrote passages into the Gospels showing that they were the authors. And here's where he really gets into it. One famous prophecy is about the coming of someone Jesus calls the Son of Man. Now, many believe he's talking about the second coming, but it's already happened. Because remember, he is, and if it happened at all, he's a second season guy, Joseph Atwell. Jesus makes specific prophecies about the Son of Man's visitation, which these four right here are four specific examples of Jesus's prophecies of the Son of Man's visitation. Okay, you ready for them?
Mm-hmm.
Number one, the Galilee towns will be crushed. It's number one. Number two, Jerusalem will be encircled with a wall. Number three, the temple will be raised, leaving no stone intact. And numero cuatro, he'll appear before the generation that hears Jesus' words passes away.
That's a big argument with the little season folks, too, is that especially JT brings this up, is he calls it audience relevance. And when Jesus is talking, I don't know if it's Sermon on the Mount or Olivet Discourse or one of these, you know, famous speeches, he specifically says, this generation will not pass away till they see me come back. And how is that taken? It's a genuine question by people who think the rapture and the second coming is yet to happen. How does that make sense 2,000 years later?
It's sort of like the Jehovah's Witness thing with the 144,000. Isn't that what they believe the Jehovah's Witnesses? It's 144,000 of them get to heaven, and that's all that heaven can allow. It's a limited heaven, and that's the VIP room. That's it. But if you total up all the saints who are promised to get there and everything, heaven's already full. So they're basically just preaching not to go to heaven. But I don't know that that leap is necessarily made. Do you see what I'm saying? They're preaching on behalf of a heaven that's already full. But they're so convinced that that's what they should be doing. But again, if it's a numbers game, I've heard people relate that 144,000 to many other things. So it could, again, be allegorous, not literal. So, for instance, the chakras, they say that if you add up all the petals on all the flowers of all of the chakras, it equals 144,000. I know. Weird shit. So there are many other allegories for this kind of thing. And then it's also important to remember that to the Jews of that era, a generation was 40 years. So the only person that Jesus predicts could be the Son of Man is Titus Flavius. Titus Flavius destroyed the Galilean towns, encircled Jerusalem with a wall, and raised the temple within 40 years. Josephus recorded that no matter how Titus tortured the Jews, they refused to call him Lord or God. To circumvent this stubbornness, the Flavians wrote the Gospels predicting the future arrival of a Son of Man. Titus fulfilled these prophecies and became the Son of Man, leading to the unknowing worship of Titus, not Jesus. Joseph Atwell supports his thesis that the Flavians originated Christianity by highlighting the Roman Catholic Church's earliest saints, known as the Christian Flavians. The Flavian family had several unusual connections to early Christianity. Many members were among the first Roman Catholic saints, including Flavia Domitilla, Titus's sister or niece, depending on who you ask, and the first Christian saint. Her son, Clement, great name, not, becoming the first Roman Catholic pope after the Apostle Simon. Two members of the Flavian household staff, Nereus and Achilles, had churches named after them in the earliest Christian diocese in Rome. Now, remember how I asked you about the Christian symbols last time?
Yeah.
The cross is not one of them. The cross was significant for other reasons, and we're definitely going to get to that in another episode. And I feel that that's a lot of the metaphor that's couched in there. And I'll give you a hint. The cross is your neck to your spinal cord and to your shoulders. That's, you are the man who dies on the cross, and we all have our own cross to bear. And so it's metaphor, and we'll get there when we get to tissue salts. That's one of mine. Like, you've got a big project you're working on to research and make sure you do it right. That's one of mine. I mean, I've been at it for weeks. I've known about it for a long time. I've been hard studying it for weeks, and we'll present it when we're ready here, but it applies there. So we'll get back to the cross as a Christian symbol then, but don't forget about it. But Christian theologian Titus Flavius Clement of Alexandria described the first Christian symbols, the anchor, the boat, the fish, the olive branch, and the star were the same symbols used on the coins of the Flavian Caesars.
How coincidental.
How coincidental.
Oh my God. That took me a half second more than it should have.
I know. God. And I, as it was coming out, I was like, don't do it. Don't do it. But there it went.
You couldn't stop yourself.
No. The Flavian family's connection to Christianity is evident in the 4th century when Flavius Constantine made Christianity the state religion of Rome. Remember the Council of Nicaea?
I do. I was there.
Oh, were you? Oh, shit. What's he really look like in real life? What's he smell like? That's what I want to know.
Ass.
Oh. Now, the military achievements of Caesar were significant to all Romans. So the Flavian Christians, the first saints of the Roman Catholic Church, would have known about Titus Flavius, the son of man Jesus predicted to crush Galilee, encircle Jerusalem, and destroy the temple. Joseph Atwell uncovered a secret code used by the Flavians in their documents, providing intriguing evidence of their origin. They left evidence. The Romans studied the Jewish scripture in their imperial court and discovered a unique literary code hidden in the text. Now, this code, known as typology, was used by the Flavian military team to place passages into the Gospels that needed decipherment. Typology is a genre used in ancient Hebraic literature, but it's no longer widely understood or used today. It involves using events from the past to provide form and context for subsequent ones. Typology involves creating multi-layered texts by retelling old stories in new forms and superimposing contemporary history upon them. Think about The Little Mermaid.
Yeah.
There you go.
It just reminds me of archetypes. I mean, patterns, cycles, that type of idea.
This is the thing, though. I don't know why, you know, because then you debate this. You go, well, if it's that obvious and typology is this thing we all know about and is common in Hebraic typology, Hebraic literature, and everyone knew about this, why use it? Why not mix the thing up? Why not arrange shuffle the cards up a little bit and play them in a different order? They don't. They're played in the exact same order, which tells a few things. I mean, that's part of the literature. That's part of the story of the book. That's part of the work because it is a tale all the way through, if you're depending on how you're reading it. And it can be read multiple ways, which is what is also fascinating. But this was the deal. This typology was a way to encode messages very deep in storytelling with characters, with motif, with archetypes. And everybody gets some morals out of the thing and learns something new and is possibly controlled a little bit along the way. In Hebraic typology, texts were designed to be read in comparison to one another, revealing hidden meanings. In the surface narration, the typology connection between the stories becomes apparent to someone who understands it. Hebraic typology connects prophets, placing events from one prophet's life into the life of a subsequent prophet, establishing a divine pattern connecting God's prophets. Like the seizure boards guy. Oh man, I painted a painting of my son as Jesus, therefore I'm the daddy of Jesus, therefore I'm God. It's this idea of, oh, well, I'm in a lineage of prophets.
I always thought that was weird too, that classic picture people have in their mind of Jesus being this like long-haired white dude. It's so odd, like, and everybody else around him wasn't?
Yeah.
Or what?
Like he would have just blended in as a white dude in Egypt at that time.
Yeah.
Or anywhere, really, in that time. That there were a variety of shades of wheat out there, but not many of the melanin he was proclaimed to have. And we think that this is part of the apprehension. And I love it too, because you get those things like Mary's, okay, somebody I know's aunt. I'm not going to say who it was. Somebody I know's aunt sent out pictures of Jesus, but it was really the Obi-Wan Kenobi thing from... It was homeboy, what's his name?
The actor?
Yes, from the new one.
Oh, I don't know.
Anyway, you know what I'm talking about. Obi-Wan Kenobi. Okay. Yeah, she had that, was totally convinced that was... Oh, praise him. And I'm like, yeah, he's a great actor. I'm not praising him, but, you know, I think he's done some good work. I liked his Long Way Down, Long Way Round series. They did great until they got to the electric bikes and fucked it for everybody. Have you ever seen that?
No.
Him and his buddy go ride motorcycles like around the world. And it's freaking awesome. It's a great story.
The actor or Obi-Wan Kenobi?
No, the actor. And he doesn't even really do any Obi-Wan Kenobi, which is unfortunate. He's just him, Ewan McGregor. That's it. I know somebody was yelling it at their shit. So he goes around, they ride motorcycles. And it's honestly a brilliant show. The first two seasons, again, I wouldn't get wrapped up in anything beyond that. The Gospels reveal this hidden code, the typology used to create the Jesus story. All right, so are you ready for this? Now, at the beginning, Matthew takes events from the Old Testament and places them in Jesus' life with the same sequence as in the Old Testament. Numerous Bible scholars, of course, have identified parallels between the stories. Now, both have a patriarch named Joseph who goes from Israel to Egypt, a ruler who massacres innocent boys, a divine character who states that all men are dead who sought your life, and a return from Egypt to Israel. There's also a metaphor from descension to ascension, which may also have to do with the Christal concept within your physical vessel.
Well, apparently Jesus went to India and Japan and everything too, according to their legends. So.
Man, I love that he died over there. Have you seen that?
No.
Yeah, there's a shrine to him and everything. People take wooden crosses. It's very subtle. Honestly, it makes a lot of sense. If you want to just kind of duck out of the way, you want to be chucked somewhere, people aren't going to go hump your grave like the Doors lead singer, then you just, you know, go do it in Japan. Someplace people don't even know that you even went, according to your legend.
How did he even get there? I guess they had boats.
And here's another thing. Like, let's say that it's another level to the Jesus is real story. Is that, no, he wasn't over there. He was buried somewhere else. It kind of reminds me, again, of the Nazis on the moon. There's a hollow moon. There's stuff going on the moon. When we went to the moon, this happened, and it was crazy. Again, it all presupposes the moon is a place you can go. And I think this idea of even adding more layers to the Jesus story, even conspiracy beyond sort of this, which I enjoy. I like the conspiracy of it. It's fun. Then it just, again, adds more weight to the presupposition that he was a real dude. He historically walked around, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
Slippery slope gang. That's all. They also share events involving passing through water. In the Old Testament, the Israelites pass through the Red Sea, while in Matthew, Jesus undergoes baptism and passes gas under and through water. Now, finally, they both enter the wilderness, with the Israelites spending 40 years there and Jesus spending 40 days there. Now, finally, we have three temptations. In the Old Testament, we have the temptation by bread, the statement, do not tempt God, and the commandment to worship only God. These appear again in Matthew, where Jesus is tempted by bread and tells the devil, do not tempt God, and instructs him to only worship God. Comparing Jesus' life to Moses' life shows a divine connection between the characters in the Gospels and the Old Testament. Moses' life foreshadows Jesus' claim to be the next savior of Israel. To understand the rest of Jesus' story, his adult ministry bit, we need to know that the same systems of parallel names, locations, and concepts connecting Jesus and the Gospels to Titus and Josephus' work was used. Scholars explain this gospel typology in three examples. Are you ready for these? So Jesus begins his ministry at the Sea of Galilee, gathering his disciples and saying, "Do not be afraid, follow me, become
fishermen.
Fishers of men. Very good. Great job. In Luke, Jesus says, "Catchers of men." Now Titus arrives at the same location, gathers his troops and says, "Don't be afraid, follow me, we'll attack a group of Jewish rebels." This is the quote, actually happened. Now they sink their boats, and the Jews attempt to swim to safety, and the Romans catch them using the tips of their spears, becoming fishers of men.
Spear fishers.
Ooh, it puts a new spin on that timeless tale, doesn't it there, Bubba?
They're going to wreck the meat, though. You can't just spear them.
Yeah, I think it taints the meat if they're scared. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, while the match isn't exact, it's a repeated type in the New Testament. Jesus constantly deals with devils. He's always got the devils he's dealing with. Josephus defines these devils as individuals with a rebellious spirit who rebel against Rome. So again, it's like the old conspiracy theorists. They would call you a devil if you rebelled against Rome, because that wasn't good. You didn't want that. But if you're questioning the official narratives coming out of the nasty authoritative mouthpiece, lizard turds, conspiracy theorists. It's like, it's again, and now I think that this is, you know, you could see the typology right here. It's just rebranded.
Nothing new under the sun. All you have to do is make somebody look stupid or call them stupid, and then everything they say, you don't have to pay attention to anymore.
So or racist, right?
Pay your taxes, you know, do your civic duties. Don't question it.
Ugh. There is relief, guys. Just seek it. Okay. Jesus constantly deals with devils again. Now, these are the guys that spoke out against Rome, these conspiracy theorists. At Gadara, Jesus encounters a man possessed by a legion of demons, like 30 dudes among the dead. Jesus drives out the Pharisees who infect a herd of swine and rush into the water.
I always thought that was a weird way to deal with demons. Like, okay, they're out of you now, but fuck those pigs.
Yes, that's exactly right. That's, yeah, why pass your shit off to somebody else? We live out here in the country, and they'd say about gophers, like, you can get them and you can pick them up in a water bucket. You take a gallon jacket, you dump it over the hole, the thing swims up, and now he's in the bucket. But the thing is now you don't want to run down the road and set it free, because now you've made it somebody else's problem. The deal is to just handle your own business, right? And see, yeah, you would think that if you drive this out into something else, why is that fair? How is God cool with that? That seems
a little
shitty.
The pigs run off a cliff, and it's like, well, is that the end of that demon, or did it jump out and continue on its way?
Yeah, so they rushed into the water. And this parables Titus's battle, because they know this, because it parables Titus's battle at Gadara, where a single individual infects a legion of Jews with his demonic spirit, the idea, right? Who then infect another group, leading them to be driven into the sea. The gospel suggests a grim parable to this military event, with the Romans having a dark sense of humor. In a medieval text, the Gospel of Barnabas, the story is presented in an unsophisticated form, revealing Jewish rebels being chased into the sea and drowning. In the Gospels, these are presented as pigs. Josephus' biography describes him encountering three friends being crucified and pleading for their release, which Titus grants. Two died and one revived. This incident provides a clear example of how ideas might have been conceived by gospel writers, doesn't it? It's strange that a dramatic occurrence appears in the Gospels at all. In the Gospels, Joseph of Arimathea asks the Roman commander to remove Jesus from the cross. In Josephus' history, Joseph Barmathias asks the Roman commander to do the same. Take someone down from the cross. Arimathea is a pun on Josephus' last name, Bar-Matthias. You see it?
Barnabas?
Bar-Matthias.
Oh.
B-A-R.
Because there's Barabbas too, right? He was one of the guys on the cross.
Or
no, he got pardoned maybe?
Yeah, that was the two dudes. And really, they're a metaphor for Ahriman and Lucifer, if you think about it. And choosing the middle path, which is the man crucified upon the cross, which is probably your body. See, that's all metaphor. Very interesting. Have you ever heard of that name, though, Arimathea?
Yes.
Where from? Outside of the Bible, maybe?
No, just in the Bible.
Oh. Well, outside of the Bible, have you ever seen Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy?
Yes.
Or read the book? Okay. In that, Arimathea is the religious planet that they go to where John Malkovich is running this nose cult. Do you remember that?
Oh, really? No, I don't remember that.
Yeah, they keep screaming,
not that long ago.
Arimathea, Arimathea, that's where they needed to go. And they push that improbability drive, end up getting there. And then that's the John Malkovich character. And they're all, what, in a religion, praising a cult that sounds weird to us because it's just a nose. And they believe that they were sneezed out in a great big bang and have this entire cult related to it. And that planet was called Arimathea.
Isn't that
interesting?
Great movie.
How authors, like the author of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, will then encode actual biblical references to stuff like that.
It's all over in Hollywood, dude. Classic movie. I mean, even Star Wars and stuff like that. They all have this, not only the Campbell stuff of the hero's journey. I mean, Lord of the Rings, all of these things. They all have these same metaphors, just dressed in a different, you know, style.
Yeah, Disney, all of it. Yeah, absolutely. Now, when you read sources carefully, you'll find that they're effectively well hidden. Our literature is often propaganda influenced by the Romans. The Dead Sea Scrolls, though, offer a glimpse of literature unfiltered by Roman filters. And that's why Atwell found them so important, because the Romans didn't get to them. And they portray a very different group of folks. They wanted everybody out of Israel. They were not pacifist whatsoever. That's why it's so important to the work here, is to find an older work from the area that the people said that the Bible was written from, but really it's not the same work whatsoever. Didn't have the Roman filters on it, right? It wasn't propagandized. It wasn't scrubbed, neutered. Josephus wrote in an era where allegory was considered a science. That's very cool if you think about it, that they didn't hide things. They had to hide things, or the way that they hid things. If you think about subcarrier waves in radio frequencies now, if you're being beamed as you're watching something, if you're being beamed something in a subcarrier frequency that's really programming you to some level, this is the ancient art of doing that through words. Very cool. Hmm.
And it took a lot more talent, too.
And that's the thing. They couldn't, and painting was another one of these. You look at Leonardo da Vinci, any of these guys who were painting these very deep esoteric concepts, Michelangelo and God, but really God's inside the brain, which is, you know, all of these things.
Oh, yeah.
Very deep, but they couldn't come out and just say it. And so same thing. This, in the way that it's done today, I would suppose it is more propaganda. It's more to offer us the Kali Yuga experience. But really, it seems in this way, it was to suppress, but also enlighten. Like if you could read between the lines, which you can do today. Again, there's a lot of great information in here. It's the thinking that there's a dude that did these things, that snakes are talking, all that, right? That's where I kind of depart from it.
Da Vinci is an odd cat anyway, and there's a lot of debate over whether he was a real person himself.
Ooh,
so
like
maybe
Shakespeare?
A show on that sometime.
Oh, let's totally do a show on that.
Shakespeare, shout out my buddy John. He just sent me it's just a meme, so I don't know if it's even a real idea, but that Shakespeare was actually a African-American woman. So, hey,
oh,
we'll have to look into that.
Well, didn't an African-American woman also write The Matrix and what was the other movie that she wrote that was huge that she didn't get any credit for?
Oh, and the Wachowskis just stole it?
Yes. And it was the
Wachowski
Matrix
sisters now, yes.
Oh, that's right. Nice balls, man. So educated readers were expected to see deeper meanings in religious texts beyond their surface narration. And that's the point that I'm also making this, is there's a ton of great shit beyond the surface narration in there. Roman and Jewish literature are sophisticated, multi-layered, and elusive. Ooh. They're trickier than modern readers suspect. It's complex, allegorical literature that indulges in Roman literary games. Now, understanding Roman literature in this period helps us to see the games played in Christian literature. The other scholars have noticed these parallels, but they have failed to notice their sequential nature by creating a typological pattern. The Flavian thesis reads these texts in contexts, considering the text, context, and subtext. You must read all of the elements to understand them fully. Unfortunately, many religious people who graduate from seminaries and religious colleges lack the level of reading training needed, which is to question the so-called established thought and challenge the claims of tyrannical fascists.
I always thought that was weird with seminaries. You can't be a pastor unless you go to seminary and regurgitate. It's the same thing as getting a degree at a university. It's like you don't graduate unless you successfully repeat after me for four years. It's really strange.
It's exactly the same. And why would any other discipline be spared, especially something so important? Makes sense to have some gatekeepers up in that bitch. Instead, they're trained to read literally, which is unfortunate and needs to be challenged. Joe, you don't think that's being done today, Bubba, do you? You think that's
no, of course not.
We wouldn't, we're not.
No, we've evolved since then.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Okay, I needed that. Thank you. So by studying the multiple layers in ancient texts in the original Greek language, Joseph Atwell discovered 40 typological parallels between the Gospels and the works of Josephus. The parallels show that Jesus' ministry followed the military campaign of Titus Flavius through parallel names, locations, and concepts. Once understood, the system the Flavians used to link Jesus and Titus, Atwell discovered dozens of these parallels in the same sequence. This proves that these unusual parallels were created deliberately as a signature by the Flavians to claim authorship of the Gospels. They couldn't even leave their name out of it. They had to put a signature stamp on it, kind of like a, oh, we were here, you know,
the Bible's still copywritten, so.
Is it copywritten?
The Bible is, yeah.
Okay, by who?
I don't know.
We could look it up. Yeah.
I mean, obviously all the new, all the various translations obviously are, but I believe even the King James is still copywritten. I might fact check myself on that.
Huh. Okay. But I wonder if anybody's been sued for copyright infringement for the Bible.
That'd be pretty tough to do because it's all over the place. So,
and depending on where you are, because you have freedom of religion. But that's not to say that you have freedom to repeat a proprietary religion that's copywritten. Man, that's fascinating.
Let's see.
How weird. Imagine God getting you on a technicality because you republished some of the work of the Bible that was copywritten and you didn't get permission first. And that's what damns you to the eternal hellfire.
Okay, so according to Google AI, which, as you know, is 100% accurate.
Totally accurate.
It says the KJV Bible is not copyrighted in the United States, where it is in the public domain, but it is protected by perpetual crown copyright in the UK.
What is perpetual crown copyright?
Perpetual crown copyright.
Is there a blue link to that? Can we know more about that?
Let's see.
We copy
crown
and paste
copyright rights in the authorized version, which is another odd thing to call the Bible, the authorized version, are vested in the crown and administered by the crown's patentee, Cambridge University Press. Perpetual restriction. Unlike standard copyrights, this crown copyright does not expire. It is a royal prerogative that has been in place since 1611. So it does say usage guidelines. This is, you may not freely publish or print the KJV in the UK without a license, though the crown typically allows for non-commercial or liturgical use of up to 500 verses. How bizarre is that?
Well, and think about it. We're a publishing house, okay? The only reason that you copyright anything is because it's considered intellectual property. So if there's no IP going on here, then what's the need for the copyright? And why would you be so concerned about people reproducing it? It's a money thing, and it's definitely a story thing. So someone wrote this story and wants credit for it, and they have a copyright on it.
Very odd.
This is so interesting. Okay. So let's kick off these parallels. Now, both Jesus and Titus begin their campaigns at the Sea of Galilee, followed by a journey to the Galilean countryside and Jerusalem. They pause before entering the city and then left after their campaigns ended. To catalog the parallels, he named each one based on the concept in that particular set. Starting at Galilee, each episode occurred in both the gospel stories of Jesus and the history of Titus's military campaign. Now, both Jesus and Titus journeyed to Jerusalem, sending messengers ahead to meet him upon arrival. When the Romans arrive in Jerusalem, they observe internal strife among the Jewish fractions. And at this point, Jesus speaks of a house divided against itself cannot stand. Josephus records that Titus ordered the cutting down of fruit trees between the Roman camp and Jerusalem's walls in preparation for battle. Jesus then instructs cutting down fruit trees that don't bear fruit. Titus seeks the best location for a tower to launch his attack. And Jesus questions the cost of building a tower. Oh, is it even worth it? Oh, the prices of lumber today.
How many shekels is that?
How many shekels? Titus sends Josephus to negotiate peace terms with the Jews. Jesus describes a king sending a delegation for peace. Both Jesus and Titus triumphantly enter Jerusalem, and stones are said to cry out. Then they drive out thieves from the temple area. Titus encircles Jerusalem with a wall, and Jesus predicts the same. So you can see how this worked out. There's already three things in here that this dude did that Jesus said would happen, and that would be the Son of Man that would come and be the Jesus that would be the second coming here.
So chicken or egg?
That's it. Chicken or egg. And I'm going to say the story is the root of all of it. And I'd say, honestly, man's desire to know more and to connect to the infinite and to know itself deeper would be the root of all of it. Someone inserting a story and offering wisdom, but also offering it in a misleading way to where your discernment is also offered in the growth process as well.
That's kind of how I've always seen it, is that it's I've said this many times, but that that story, it plays on the need for people to find meaning and et cetera, life after death, all that kind of, and it puts it in this nice gift wrap box for everybody that has all the answers in it. And I just think reality is way weirder than a little box you can just wrap everything up in.
It's gotta be. Starvation sets in here back at the temple, and Josephus writes of a woman named Mary who kills her son, eats him, and turns him into a human Passover lamb.
Yummy.
This is one of Casey Anthony's ancestors, huh? Ooh, too soon. The Gospels then describe the Last Supper, where Jesus instructs his disciples, of course, to take, eat, and drink of my sexy body and special blood, which is, of course, not weird at all. Not weird at all. Just bring it.
Oh, it's even weirder is that, I mean, I know the Baptists don't think it's actually Jesus' body and blood at communion, but the Catholics do. They think when the priest waves his hand over it and says abracadabra that it becomes Jesus' blood and body. Creepy. I'm sorry. That's just weird.
Not weird at all. It's a way to salvation, man. What are you talking about? Are you just interested in, you like Satan, huh?
It is very, I mean, besides the obvious cannibalistic implications there, It is odd to say that if you eat this person and you believe you are actually eating a human and drinking its blood, that is the way to immortality. That sounds like what some of the so-called lizard turds have been doing, a la these files that have been released.
And it's funny you said this, because I had noted here to mention that it sounds like one of these lizard turds with some shit, especially the communion aspect of it, was sitting there in the room going, hey, let's add this little bit in too, because we like to eat people. And then the literalists will perhaps at some point take this literally and eat people, or at least have an excuse when people eaters are found of, it's kind of in the Bible. Maybe they were just, you know, they got demons in them, be gone. And then healed. But man, it's an odd thing to put in there. It's very unsettling.
Odd thing to say. Yes.
What a peculiar thing to add. So this reveals the Flavian authorship of the Gospels, Atwell says, and Mike drop for all of those different examples. So let's wrap this up with the conclusions. The author's fingerprints are evident in these texts. Decoding these texts reveals startling conclusions about the early rise of Christianity. Now, our rebel scholars with a devil-may-care attitude have shown that the Gospels were not written by primitive Jewish fishermen, but are sophisticated literary works combining religious ideas with Roman political perspective. It's like, yeah, we got all these great ideas. Let's chuck some propaganda in there as well. Joseph Atwell's research reveals that reading Josephus concurrently with the New Testament shows that Jesus' life events are not historical, but depend on the military campaign of Titus Flavius. Jesus Christ was an allegory for the Roman Caesar Titus, the Messiah of the Roman Empire and the Roman son of a god that Christianity was set up to worship. Now, no one is undermining the positive aspects of Christianity. I mean, common sense folk acknowledge the positive aspects of Christianity and of other religions. However, the issue is the historical claims of these religions, the literal interpretations and motives for their existence. Traditionally, religious dogma has forbidden the examination of historical discoveries or the inclusion of scientific findings in their teachings, asking followers to blindly believe as they say, not as objective facts may show. The new intellectual renaissance is getting fed up with the many structures recognizing major frauds in financial markets and industries and pulling the plug on them. And this is the time period it's all predicted to happen. So here we are. Atwell believes that we have another fraud, the biggest of all, which is the fraud of the heart of Christianity. It's important to hear diverse voices to arrive at one's own conclusions. That's what we're saying. Take a second opinion look at it, perhaps. And our scholar homies' theories contribute to that diversity. Now, when people hear that the story of Jesus is a myth, it's helpful to have this information widely available for anyone who wants to know. And Atwell says, people feel that you're taking something away, but you're really not. You push people and ask, why do you believe in the historical Jesus? And they say, the Bible. When you ask, have you studied it as a historical document? They'll say, no. That's not the real reason that anybody enjoys that thing. The real reason is they have a personal relationship with Jesus and they don't want to lose it. And that's a good reason for a Gnostic, but a bad reason for a literalist. The Gnostics and pre-Christian pagan mystery schools believed the myth of the dying and resurrecting God-man, which was an allegory for the personal growth, to die to our lower nature and to rise to our higher nature. The literalists took control of the original myths and shaped them to take power away from the individual and place it in a central authority. Jerk off motion. Rediscovering the original myths gives people the freedom to choose to explore spiritual paths that serve them. Some Christians have developed their faith to the extent that Christ is an energy or a force within them. They interpret the story as an allegory again. And no one has an issue with the Christ within, but issue can be taken with the church militant. Organized, regimentized religion taken seriously that can act out its worst presets. If we examine all religions, we find a common thread that connects all faiths and people. And this connection gives us the choices that are critical to our future. Joseph Atwell focuses on the origins of religious ideas and that they're very unifying underneath. And the divisiveness that we see on the surface is actually just a sign of our underlying unity. Our origins can be traced back to nature worship, to the study of the sun, the moon, the stars, and the planets. And this knowledge has been cherished for thousands of years, and it's crucial for us to reconnect with our roots. This destruction of the planet is also deeply rooted in religious ideas, and restoring harmony is of the utmost importance. So he sums it up with this. To survive, we must view history from a new perspective, clarifying historical facts while honoring the wisdom of myths. Each generation inherits the myths, which become their truth. The actual history is complex and beyond the average person's comprehension. And I'll say that that's right at the threshold of their programming and not beyond their ability to adjust their programming with new information delivered with honor, kindness, and witness through action, I would say. And we can do that, right, Joe?
Yeah, of course.
Because kindness is just love with its work boots on, you know? So though we may never know all the facts about 2,000 years ago, these quirky bastard scholars contribute to a growing dialogue and paradigm shift that can lead to a more empowered and enlightened humanity. Understanding our culture's origins, particularly Christianity, is crucial in this endeavor. It's an invention of the Romans designed to pacify their subjects. This knowledge challenges our understanding of government, its tools, and its purpose. Let's end it here with a quote from from Papa Atwell himself. Evangelical Christians debunk facts as mere theories, citing religious dogma for their positions. The influence of this dogma in the media is increasing. I challenge these extremists to consider my findings. While Christianity has good, we must understand how rulers have used it to control us and continue to do so. Citizens should be skeptical when authority figures use faith to interpret laws or beliefs in Armageddon to create policies. The Flavians encoded a secret message in the Gospels, which we can now understand. You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free.
So when you're talking about how the blind faith part, where especially with, like I mentioned before, with the Catholic Church and being, you know, at least they used to do their sermons in Latin and nobody could understand what the hell they were saying. And they're just like, don't worry, we'll interpret God's words for you. You need us. You have to tell your sins to us. And, you know, you say so many Hail Marys and you'll be good to go. That's odd to me just out the gate. But there's a verse that says it is the glory of God to conceal a matter and to search out a matter is the glory of kings. So there's another verse, though, too, that says God is not the author of confusion. And what is the last 2,000 years of all these different Christianity sects but confusion? There's so many. What did we say? 4,000 or something like that?
Oh, different, easy. Yeah.
Different versions of Christianity. How is that not confusion? And I'm not blaming God for that. I'm blaming people.
Yes.
Because they're using their own interpretation to be like, no, this is what God means. And it's like, and then you go and do your own. Dirty words here, do your own research, come to your own conclusions, God forbid, even though that's also in there to search out a matter. So do you know where I'm going with this?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's a wild thing to invest one's faith in the ideals. And like you said, I think that statement is absolutely true, the bit about confusion. God is not confusion. That's the thing, is if it's confusing, it's not God. Maybe you look at it like that. If it's confusing, it's not God. Or there's a great truth in there to be found that does represent something beautiful. You just got to dig it out of the nonsense, you know, dig it out of the shit.
Yeah. But that's also considered not heretical, maybe, but to come to your own conclusions about things is like, oh, no, you have to hear what the people said that went to seminary because they know what they're talking about.
And it's I'll refer you back to the, is that confusing to you? Because if you look around, this realm is a fuck around and find out realm. It's about discovery. It's you got to do this, try, discover, find out, experiment, play, do science about it. And so to question the official narrative, like you can do that in any other discipline except that one, silly, it's out. And that's confusing. Why is that the only one? If you can start asking questions that separate it out in a big way like that and really just get you in the gut, like what you're talking about, it can't be the way. And interpretation was one of the biggest ones for me.
On the same token, a lot, well, at least the particular faction I grew up in would say that Christianity is not a religion. It is a relationship, a personal thing with God. I'm like, okay, so I have my own personal way of engaging with God. And then they say, no, that's not the right way. And it's like, wait, what? I thought you said it was personal, though. No, but it goes against what the pastor said. And it's like, well, then that's religion, not a personal relationship. Like, where's the disconnect here?
It's like having a favorite Batman. It's like, okay, are you talking about the Batman, the character, or the folks over the time who have played Batman, the character? Because either way, it's a story made up from somebody else. But depending on what relationship you have with Batman, like, who is your favorite Batman, for instance, Joe?
Probably Christian Bale.
Really? Okay, cool. Mine's Kevin Conroy, and only the nerds will get that one. So, yes, it's an example of that. It just goes so damn deep. And this is the whole point with this, is to abandon the literalism of this is what I feel is going to be the most empowering. Now, keep the Bibles, okay, guys? Don't go burning your Bibles, because there's still a lot that we have to dig out of that thing, because there's a lot of great information in there. Again, the astrotheological way to look at it. You've got so many things to do with, again, your physical vessel. They're just couched in metaphor. So now that we've chucked, released, right, you're the snake. We just got rid of that. Now we're in the year of the fire horse. We're fire horsing that chucking skin off, and you got to shed that skin off. And now we go, okay, well, what's pure here? You know, again, what is the gift? Because there is definitely gifts inside that thing now that we've stripped away the literalism of it.
Yep. And obviously, not that I need to say it, but this is heretical even talking about this to some people, but I would encourage you to think about it yourself and maybe not pass judgments on people who think differently, because it is a personal journey, a personal relationship. I have my own thing. Me and God, we're great, doing great. I don't go to church. I don't subscribe to a lot of the ideas that humans put forth that they say is what the Bible means. I just disagree with you, and that's fine. We can disagree, but that doesn't mean that I hate God or Jesus. So just to clear that up.
I got no beef with any of it. It's, again, just understanding the methods, and this makes so much more sense to me than the questions I had against taking it literally. Because like you, there were things in there, like, I'm like, hang on, so we're supposed to eat this dude? Hang on, snakes are talking, why don't they do that now? Or can all snakes talk? And Harry Potter, they can, but can I just not hear them? It's one of these things. It just makes you ask all these confusing questions about shit. Why are all women then supposedly punished for this pain that one chick did? Why is the Bible replete with God never kills, the devil was a murderer from the beginning, murders a bunch of people, and then says that the devil tricked everybody, maybe then portraying the whole damn thing as a devil? So again, now we're back to Howdy Mikowski's prison planet shit. We've all been screwed. All of it, again, it if you interpret it literally, it doesn't, I feel, lend to the gift that's in there. You gotta unwrap that shit. Get to the Tootsie Roll's center of that beautiful little nugget there. And I've linked a couple of Bibles, if you guys don't have one, in the show description there. We've got the King James Version, of course, just the heavy hitter. Now, that one's got a sweet crown of thorns stamped into the cover so that you can really have that image on your mind every time you open that book of wisdom there that's supposed to bring you joy and light. Then we also have the New American Bible, the Revised Edition, the Catholic Bible, as well as which translation of the Bible is the best. If you guys are confused, if you want to read this article first. Now, I will say that it is by Catholic.com. Don't let that make you think that it's skewed one way or another. But there you go. Also, we've got the video of the relief from the Arch of Titus that we talked about on the last thing. And I'm going to go ahead and link you guys the official Jesus is My Homeboy t-shirt if you have not gotten yours. This is, of course, the 100% cotton, because we're not mixing fibers up in this bitch. Okay.
Very nice.
Very nice. And of course, Atwell's Caesar's Messiah, the movie, it's a YouTube, and then his book as well. So you guys check all that stuff out down in the show description, as well as the new Inescapable podcast. And if you sign up, get them both so you can hear the first part of this banger and the other things that you and I have done, which are also bangers. And you can also get Inescapable by April 14th. You guys all sign up, you get it all for one investment there.
Yes, and if you are on Plus, stick around, and you'll find out which choice I made for the extension.
Yeah, man, this is, I'm enjoying this, Joe, really. Yeah.
Titillating.
Titillating. Yes. Well, thank you guys so much for joining us. Check the links down in the show description. Joe, you're amazing, and we will see you in the extension.
Plus extension. Thanks for being on Plus. You're the reason we do this, really.